This is the third in a series of four podcasts about the IDEO design methods, and today we'll be talking about the LEARN design methods. Last time what we touched on was the ASK and the LOOK methods, and the LEARN method, the LEARN set of methods essentially complement these two. Next slide. So essentially these techniques are a way of helping you to analyze the data that you collect after you go and do your look and ask phase. You know, once you conduct these two things, once you conduct methods from these other two phases, you're going to have a lot of data on your hands. And that data is going to be in the form of text data, and that could, or numerical data, and it could be about, you know, what people actually do, what their environments are like, their preferences for things, whatever that may be. And if you do enough of this data collection, you're going to be essentially completely overwhelmed by it. And that's actually a good thing. And so these techniques are a way of helping you to come to grips with everything that you have. So just as last time, I'm just going to kind of sample a couple of these. So this is not the entire list of LEARN methods. And I'll just describe how they can be used and perhaps give a couple examples of how this makes sense. So the next slide. We're looking at a slide that says flow analysis. Flow analysis has to do with essentially representing the flow of information through an information or an activity as it progresses through an entire system. And this is very useful when you have when you're looking at how information progresses through a system of, you know, people processes and kind of computer system processes. So a great example of this might be to say, look at where does the data go as it migrates through different places in the PeopleSoft system. So you do registration, where does that information go? Who gets notified about that? Or let's say you decide to do a course add or a course drop with an instructor's permission. What pieces of information need to be collected? So if you were to do something like that, you'd need to collect the instructor's signature, you'd have to collect perhaps the department head signature, you'd need to get clearance perhaps from the somebody at the main office. And then once that's all collected, then let's say you have to email that to somebody. Let's say that email gets punted into a system and it creates a ticket that an administrator needs to look at. And an administrator pulls up that ticket and maybe they actually look at, you know, your course registration piece of paper that you had all the signatures on. Once they have that piece of information, perhaps they actually key something in manually. Once that's done, perhaps it goes into some system that you know, needs to be looked at by somebody else, so on and so forth. And so you can see that, you know, how the information migrates through the system is not only complex, but it perhaps takes time to digest and understand. And once you have a sense of these processes, you know, representing in a flowchart helps other people to understand what's going on here too. Flow analysis is a really useful tool if you are trying to build a system for a business where they have some process for doing something, whatever that may be, purchasing, whether that may be inventory, membership registration, that sort of stuff, where information passes between multiple computer programs or multiple people. And it doesn't necessarily need to be kind of like a one-way flow. Sometimes it's backwards, right, where people need to make judgments and stuff like this. And all this stuff, if you have a representation, it allows you to take it back to your stakeholders and say, hey, actually, this is our interpretation of what's going on. Is this correct? And have them sort of debug that for you. And if you have that debugged, then it's easier for you to, whatever it is, augment or change that process, or even to, or maybe just, you know, build a system that actually represents that process correctly. Here's a quick example from the research literature. We're on to the next slide where it says, it's a thank you card. In particular, what this example will do is it'll show you kind of some of the complexities of information management, even in the home. This was a study where they were looking at trying to design interactive displays through the home and trying to figure out how to design technology for domestic spaces, essentially. And what they did was they looked at how information flowed through the home. And so they did a study where they went into people's homes and they actually tried to find information as it flowed. And in particular, the particular vignette that I'm going to share is one about a thank you card. And essentially, this story is about telling you where the thank you card goes as it moves through the house. So this seems like a complex story, but it's probably not unlike the kind of story that you would have with a thank you card in your home. So the mail comes in at the porch, somebody picks it up, and they bring it to the kitchen table. Now the person actually, in this story, actually takes the card, and they don't know it is a card yet, it's just a piece of snail mail, right? And they put it on the dinner setting of whomever it's addressed to. That person, when they get to dinner, they open up the card and they see that it's from, on Annie or something like this. And from there, they actually take that piece of mail and they bring it to the workstation, right? And the reason they bring it to the workstation, and this is a computer workstation in the home, the reason why they bring it there is because they know they need to write an email to Aunt Annie. Once the email is constructed and sent away, then it's brought back over to the sofa where the family kind of sits and reads it and looks at it, right? And they share it with one another. After that's done, it's placed on the mantelpiece, where it's basically put on display. And it's put on display for a short period of time, short meaning anywhere between a week to a couple of months, perhaps. Maybe this is a Christmas card of some sort. And then once that's done, this postcard is actually placed on the windowsill. This thank you card is actually placed on the windowsill. And so you can see that actually this thank you card moves from different places, and at each place there's something going on with that piece of information, right? So physically there is actually some flow here, and in terms of the information that it is creating or related to, there is some flow. And this image that you see right here, this is a representation of that information. So next slide. So in this slide, the point here is, so what's going on here is they're actually kind of notating different places in the home where information is dealt with, whether that be digital information or physical information. And you can see that over time, there are places that become, that are actually important in relation to information. And some of these make good sense, right? Bookshelf on the top left there, workstation, perhaps dealing with digital information. Over on the left, the phone shelf, so dealing with information where phone calls need to be made. Fireplace, I guess, to throw stuff in the fireplace. The bookshelf, the kitchen table, the notice board, right? All of these are what they call ecological habitats in this particular research project. And what they came up with at the end was this notion that, well, it's not actually the case that the home needs displays absolutely everywhere. It's only in these certain places where information is dealt with. So that was the main conclusion they came up with in this study. And one of the techniques that they used to derive this information was this flow analysis. So not only do they go in and kind of find this information from looking and asking, but now they're actually kind of synthesizing the information and representing it on a map. And that's when things become very interesting, because you can imagine taking this back to the homeowners and saying, well, so this is what we think is going on in your home. Is this actually true? Right? Next slide. So we're into error analysis now. So I think error analysis is actually a really fun tool to use, particularly as a sensitizing kind of a tool. And I like to use it as part of my workshops when I do human-computer interaction for groups. And one of the things that you do is, and what the technique, you know, the name actually tells you everything that the technique is. And all you do is basically you give people an interface or a description of an interface, and you ask them to generate all the possible problems that can come up with somebody trying to use this interface. Not only that, but you ask them to come up with all the possible reasons why these errors might occur. And so to me, it's a great technique to sort of sensitize you to an environment and to kind of force you to think about things as somebody who is completely naive to the context or the tool. And the other part is listening to what other people come up with, not only kind of your own problems, but doing it as a team and listening to what other people come up with. This sensitizes you to things and it shows you what your own biases are. So just to give you a really quick example, one of the things that we did was we would give people a remote control, just a TV remote control like the one that you see in the image here. And we would ask them to see if they could do some basic tasks, and we'd ask them to basically do an error analysis of this task, or an error analysis of this scenario. And one of the things they came up with was, and this makes perfect sense now, right? One of the things they came up with was, well, you know, often I'm using the remote control in the dark, and this not only has no lights, but now I need to turn on the lights to actually see something. Some simple things that I'd want to do are turn up the volume or turn it down. And actually, this remote control was, to me, designed very, very poorly. So it has all the functionality, but it's actually very difficult to discern which button does what because all the buttons were the exact same size. You know, once you kind of know that lesson, that, you know, often remote controls are used in the dark, you can't actually see all the buttons to read the labels, then you start to get the sense that, oh, actually, I'm going to need to design something that allows people to use their sense of touch to differentiate between buttons. And like I said, this is a great sort of brainstorming tool. So with the existing tool, what kind of problems actually come up? And that helps you to design better tools. Next slide. A related technique is cognitive task analysis. And we will actually cover this as something called task-centered system design in this class. And essentially what you do is you are given, you take a description of the interface, whether that's a physical description, like a text-based description, or a paper prototype, or something that you can actually play with. And then you essentially construct a set of tasks that you expect people to do, and then you walk through that interface, and you walk through that task step by step. You walk through the task step by step, and you ask yourself a couple of questions. First, is the person going to know what to do at this step? And then second, are they essentially motivated to do this step? And what that forces you to do is it forces you to be in the mindset of the person that is trying to complete their task, right? Trying to complete some goal. And it forces you to become very aware of what they have in their hands, what they're looking at in the moment, and all the decisions that they're trying to make. So it puts you in that cognitive frame of mind. So just as, next slide. So just as a quick example, it turns out a whole bunch of design work has gone into the design of airplane cockpits. And if you look at this kind of environment, you can see that there's a lot of stuff going on, a lot of inputs, a lot of displays with trying to give you information. And so they often do these kind of cognitive tasks analyses in this type of space, because the point is, you know, if an alarm goes off, is this person going to be able to find the source of the alarm, and are they going to know what to deal, you know, what to do and how to deal with it, right? So cognitive task analysis tends to be a very useful tool once you have a very well spelled out interface and a very well spelled out set of tasks that you like people to accomplish. Next slide. Right, so task-centered system design. So this is a technique that's related to cognitive task analysis. I think it's just, think of cognitive task analysis as being a body of other techniques, and task-centered system design is one of these. In fact, there's a reading that I've linked to in the reading section of the webpage, so you can take a peek at this. And I think it's a really, really cool tool. And like I said, I'll get into it later on in this course, but it's a really, really neat tool. Next technique is to use the information that you have and to construct long-range forecasts. So based on what you have, essentially write up a series of paragraphs that tell you kind of how you expect scenarios and to arise over the long term, whether they're describing social trends or technology trends, and in particular how these two things relate to people's behavior in relation to their use of different tools. So why predicting changes in behavior, industry, or technology can help clients to understand the implications of design decisions. So if you are kind of differentiating between two possible designs based on data that you have collected, then you can construct these really long-range forecasts to essentially explain kind of what your predictions are based on each of these designs. And this helps the people that you're working for make decisions about, you know, which design they might like. Next technique is called character profiles or personas. And essentially what you do is you go and collect information about a broad set of people. And what you will see is that when you do this, your information is going to sort of naturally bucket themselves into different kinds of categories. So let's just do this thought experiment for PeopleSoft, let's say. So when you go and let's say you were collecting information about people that use PeopleSoft, and let's say you focus specifically on students, even within this category, i.e. even within the category of students, what you'll find is that there's a range of behaviors and a range of background knowledge, domain knowledge about how a university works, about how other universities work, about how a registration system works. You'll have a range of skills, right? And what you would do is you would try to capture these in a set of, say, three or four different personas that represent the different kinds of students that you have at a school, at a particular University of Calgary. So let me just make up a couple of these. One persona might represent the first-year student who is, has a lot of experience kind of using web systems, although a lot of people do now, but they are not afraid of computer systems. They love using this stuff, but they have very little knowledge of how a university system works. They're the oldest child, and so they're the first in university. They have no experience to draw on. Another category of student might be, you know, the veteran student, you know, the career student who's been at a university for like 5 years. The reason why they're still here is because, you know, they're working part-time now. They don't live in their own home. They're a bit older. They're very savvy, and they understand kind of how the registration system works. They understand kind of the loopholes of the university, all these different things. And in between, you have all these different other kinds of categories of student that you can imagine too. And with this, you get the second person actually has a lot of experience with PeopleSoft. Here's a third category of student user. This is a person that has transferred over, let's say, from Mount Royal. So they have some experience with course registration systems. They don't know specifically how the University of Calgary works. Let's say they're a third-year student. So they understand, in principle, kind of what the role of prerequisites are and how to, you know, what is likely to be the process for getting around things, right? So you can see that and maybe they know somebody at the university already. And so, in principle, that can be somebody that they can ask for help from. Right, so you can see that there are these three different kinds of users, and they're actually very different, right? And these character profiles, they end up being very useful because you can, if you give them names, so in this case, let's call one of these people Chris, you can actually say things to your development team, hey, you know, somebody like Chris is not going to be able to understand how to use this system, right? Somebody like who's like Tom, who has lots of experience with this system, is going to understand this error dialogue that you've designed here. But Chris is not going to be able to figure this out. So how are we going to support somebody like Chris? Right. So personas are a really useful tool because they bring customers to life. And this is a great example of essentially that notion of having a lot of data that you've collected from using your look and ask methods and trying to synthesize that. Right. So next slide. Personas are constructions that represent different kinds of users. These are based off user research and represent general classes of people. And you can use them as a design resource as you're going. And you can think about these personas as if they were real people, because they help you to make decisions about whether your system actually makes sense for them. So if you go to the next two slides here, you can see here are some examples of personas. These are some really nicely designed kind of presentations of how these personas might look. One thing that they'll show you is that personas are particularly useful when you have, you know, several to look at. And you can compare and contrast between these different people. And they will help bring your users to life, essentially. One of the things that we find when we're working with developers is they have this notion of, you know, who the user is very elastic. They don't really have a strong sense of what that user is, what their capabilities are, what their knowledge is. But when you create a persona and you start using a persona on a design team or on a software engineering team, it helps to make that real. And it helps you to put yourself in these personas, people's shoes, essentially. And it helps to build empathy, is what I think. All right, next slide. So we're on to anthropometric analysis. And so essentially what you're doing here is you're using human population measurement data to check coverage and suitability of a design solution for the target user group. So what this means is essentially just measuring people, right? So if you know that you're designing something for, let's just go with stereotypes, right? You're designing something for a population in the Southeast Asia, right? Here you have people that are kind of have smaller hands, they're physically smaller somehow, and if you knew that you were designing for that kind of size of hands, then you would need to take that into account in your designs. And you can't work from your assumptions of kind of even heights of where signs should be, right? And so taking this stuff into account kind of leads you to some interesting designs. So if you go into the next slide, what you can see here, just a couple of different kind of, at least one is a mock-up of a TV remote. So here, if you think about holding the TV remote on the left, actually it becomes very unwieldy. And you actually don't need to do any measurement to do this. You just need to hold this prototype in your hand, which is what's kind of cool. And you would see that, yeah, hitting the channel button is pretty easy, but actually trying to hit the volume buttons with your thumb is going to be very challenging, right? And so in fact, the remote that's sort of semi-constructed on the right, and this is something that you would get out of a look investigation, obviously, is that, you know, you find that you don't need a lot of buttons. It's okay to just have channel and volume buttons, essentially, on a lot of remotes, and this is more than sufficient. What's great about this is that when you grab the remote sort of fits in your hand in a certain way in terms of the weight, and this would work just fine. Just a short little anecdote about this. The original Xbox, actually, when it came out, so this was the precursor to the Xbox 360, which is the precursor to the Xbox One, they actually came up with the remote that was on the left. And when this thing came out, for me, and I actually think I have fairly big hands for an Asian guy, but for me, this thing was just kind of still way too big. And my preference was for the Xbox S controller, which is the one that was on the right. And so, in fact, they had designed the Xbox S controller for children, and they had designed the Xbox, like, big controller for adults. And what they had done was they had been doing this using American models. So they'd been bringing in basically American men. So they're white guys, big hands, and they tried to design something that would fit their hands. And so that's what the Xbox originally shipped with. Over time, people came to realize that, in fact, the vast majority of people didn't have the same size hands as the models that they had brought in originally. And so the Xbox S size controller is the one that has sort of become the standard in terms of the Xbox controller schemes. So in principle, you could imagine that had they done that sort of anthropometric analysis, they would have found out that, in fact, the one on the right kind of suits people's hands a little bit better, and they would have probably shrunk that thing down to start with. Next slide. So secondary research. So this is something that you can kind of imagine as a technique. So basically, you review published articles, papers, or documents, or other reviews of existing techniques and technologies that are related to the one that you are building. And essentially, you build up that understanding, and it helps you to make decisions about the product that you are designing. So this is kind of like a competitive analysis. Something that you could easily imagine doing for a lot of the projects that you were likely to have selected is to simply go and say, okay, well, so what other tools are there out there that are like the one that I have? And how do these different tools vary? What are the characteristics of these tools? What are their strengths and what are their weaknesses? And a common mistake is to do this secondary analysis based primarily on functionality. So while this is kind of an okay step, that's not the point, right? Because we're talking about design. So in terms of the design of these tools, how do these things differ? How does the way that somebody navigates through the information differ? How is information presented to them in such a way that allows them to complete their tasks, or in a way that kind of impedes them from completing a task, right? So this is what your secondary research should be trying to do if you take this step. And it's fun enough that I often recommend it to people that are doing projects in 481. Last technique that I'll talk about is affinity diagrams. I'm not going to spend too much time on this because this is something that you will do in tutorial. Essentially, an infinity diagram is basically just a mess, a collage of data that you stick up onto the wall. And then what you do is you use the wall, the spatialness of the wall, so the 2D-ness of the wall, to organize the data that you have collected. And the purpose is to cluster them such that relationships become very clear. Relationships between clusters become clear. It's a useful method to identify connections between issues and reveal innovation opportunities. This ends up being kind of a useful technique, and like I said, I'm not going to get into it too much because you will cover it in tutorial. So just in summary, really quickly, we've talked about how you can apply the learn techniques as a way to process the data that you've gathered from the ask and look techniques. Some of the learning tasks can help you figure out who to talk to for ask and look things as well. So once you've done some of these learning techniques, it'll help you to think a little bit more about your investigation phase and kind of inform some of those other techniques. All right, that's it for this time. Thanks.